Blog Talk Radio.
Dallas, Texas, on Wednesday, June 26th, day number 177 of 2013. We call it summer here in Dallas. Other people call it global warming, but it is very, very hot in Dallas this afternoon. So we greet you from Dallas, and today we're going to be talking to one of our favorite people, Monica Showalter. She's one of the editorial writers at the Investor Business Daily. This is truly one of the great opportunities. We, you know, we get to chat to a lot of people, but this is a real treat today. We're going to be talking with Monica Showalter about the situation in Brazil. A lot of interesting stuff. And, you know, as I was talking to Monica this afternoon, it caught me by surprise. I didn't see this coming down in Brazil. So we're going to get into that today with Monica in a few minutes. In our second segment today, Michael Prada, our good friend from Colombia, is going to be joining us with an update on what's happening with the negotiations with FARC. I guess there are some interesting things going on in Colombia with that. So Michael is going to be updating us on that particular situation. My book, Cubanos in Wisconsin, available in print, available in Kindle, and you can now go to the website and you can order a special copy. For example, let's say you want to dedicate a book to your Cuban uncle, to your Cuban friend. Let's say you work with a Cuban and you want to give him or her a copy of the book. You can do that. You can go to the website and order the book, and we'll be more than happy to dedicate the book to you or to that person and make it into a real neat gift. You know, I had a lot of fun for Father's Day and Mother's Day signing and dedicating books. It's a real treat for me. This is emotional, but it's a real treat for me to dedicate books to that generation because I know how important that generation was in our upbringing and what they went through to get out of Cuba. So I always get a kick out of doing that. And if you have a Cuban father, a Cuban mother, a Cuban grandmother, that's my specialty. If you have a Cuban grandmother, we'll be more, and Cuban grandfather, of course, we'll be more than happy to dedicate the book. Very quickly, on this day in history, 1945, the United Nations Charter was signed on this day. 1948, one of the great examples of American leadership, American presidential leadership, the Berlin Airlift. And this is when President Truman reacted to the Soviet Union closing down West Berlin. And President Truman said, no, you're not going to do that. And he flew airplanes into West Berlin and supported the people of Berlin with an airlift. And, you know, a couple of days ago, I was at a book signing. And in front of me, there was a lady from Germany. And we started talking. This lady is like in her late 70s. And she was telling me that she was one of the kids in West Berlin who would sit there and wait for the airplanes and get their gifts. You know, they used to call the candy, they used to send them candy or drop candy to the children. So she really put a human face on that Berlin airlift. And on this day in 1963, another great example of presidential leadership, President Kennedy went to Berlin and he said, we are all citizens of Berlin. Well, I don't know how he said it in German, but that's basically what he said. But both President Truman and President Kennedy, great examples of leadership, presidential leadership. And I mention that because we're not getting any leadership from the incumbent in the White House today. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Monica Showalter right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, and as I mentioned, it's a real treat when we get to talk to Monica Showalter, one of the really good people in American journalism and someone who really understands U.S. Latin America, and because of the newspaper that she works for, the Investor Business Daily, she's got the economics as well as the political perspective. So, Monica, it's a great honor to say hello to you.
Hi, Silvio. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. My pleasure. What? Tell us a little bit about your story. I know you did the last time, but some of the listeners may not remember.
Okay, well, let's see, I guess a couple of days ago I did write an editorial on the big demonstrations in Brazil, which took everyone off guard because, I mean, part of the reason is Brazil has a reputation as being a country that's, quote, not angry. It's a country that is not angry at anybody, that tries to be friends with everybody, or at least that's the image it has. So to see bitter turkey-style discontent flare up, and it went across the country. It was at the, you know, like at the speed of wildfire, and the demonstrations were huge. It was just astonishing. Everybody wondered, where'd that blow in from?
Yeah.
Now there are countries in Latin America that you do expect protests to happen. For instance, Venezuela, you know, where an election was stolen, or Ecuador, where freedom of speech is under attack, or Argentina, where people's pensions have been stolen. I mean, there's all kinds of disgusting, revolting outrages. And some of these places do have demonstrations, but nothing like Brazil. Brazil was the happy country. Brazil is the country that has, you know, fairly good economic growth. It's the country that hasn't, you know, when Oliver Stone did a movie called South of the Border, he interviewed all the Latin presidents who were left-wing. And Lula, who was the president of Brazil at the time, stood out as very different from the other Latin presidents because he said, well, we paid our bills. We paid off the IMF. We paid them off early, which was very different from the kind of talk you get out of Castro, who loves to tell people to go default on their debt. And
right.
Correa of Ecuador does similar, and Argentina does foolish things like this too. But Brazil doesn't talk like that. You know, Brazil had the reputation as being kind of the good socialist, or as Alvaro
right.
Vargas Llosa called it, the vegetarian socialist, whereas the others were meat-eating socialists.
Right, right.
You know,
yeah,
they
but
weren't
it's interesting. I think I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I was just going to say that I was caught by surprise. Just like, and again, I don't follow Brazil as closely as you do, but I was really caught by surprise. I mean, it just like all of a sudden, man, I thought I was watching Turkey. You know?
Yep, that was the way. That was the feeling everybody had. So it became a very intriguing thing. Where does that come from?
Yes, yes.
And that was what I made some calls around in Brazil and explored. I read as much as I could, talked to people who have been to Brazil, and kind of came up with the picture of there's kind of the thing is this: they've been socialist for so long, and the ruling party has been in power for more than 10 years, since at least 2002. But even the people before them were, you know, center-left, centrist, etc. They don't even have a conservative movement. They don't have a proper pendulum to swing. And so there's no alternatives. And so kids grow up and they think everything has to be socialist. And the thing about socialism is that it has sort of a politics of symbolism. It has a politics of, in my editorial, I talked about it being the politics of special interests. That
right.
certainly explains what the crowds were screaming about. They were saying special interests, they were saying corruption, and they were complaining about taxes, and they were talking about lousy services. And, of course, every socialist regime has lousy services. Think about the Russian fashion show of the Wendy's ad, or think about, you know, Soviet customer service. That's kind of the baseline that you have. You don't have good customer service and that in any place where you have public employee unions running things, you're unlikely to have good public service as well. And of course, that's the way it goes in Brazil. You can't get rid of those public employee unions who run the bus service and whatever. So the public and the schools, the hospitals, everybody's talking about how the hospital service is so bad. All of those things pretty well, even though it's a social democracy, you know, it's not a nasty Chavista type place where they steal people's property. They do have expropriatory taxes, and they have protectionism to protect the special interests, which drives up prices for the consumers. These people are suffering. In other words, people who are not part of the special interest club, whether you're a very poor person or, say, an ultra-rich person who's doing crony capitalism and stadium deals, etc., if you're not one of those, you're just taxed. You just get taxed. You don't get anything. You get the lousy services. And then the government will say, oh, everything's good. But even the poor were discontented too, because who wants to live on handouts? You live on handouts, and then the left doesn't realize, look, people who are on handouts would like that as a leg up, not a lifestyle decision. So you're stuck right. like in a ghetto of being dependent, which is just miserable. And you're told, you know, you're going to stay in the slum and get your government check every week, and you have nothing to look forward to. So that's very, that's exhausting. That's draining. That's
right.
not a happy place.
No, not at all. It's interesting.
Socialists think that's all I have to do: throw junk at people, just throw
right.
money at people.
Let me just briefly mention this, because I was really interested, since it caught me by surprise. I began to read some of the stories that were coming out. The Reuters, you know, the stories in the American, in the Western media, not the local press too much, but the Western media. And I found fascinating some of the interviews they were doing with the man and woman in the street. And this one lady had an amazing quote. She said, number one, the transportation is lousy when I go to work. I don't even know if I'll get home because of all the violence. The schools are horrible. The taxes are high. So she was basically complaining about all of these things that you're just talking about. And it's really, this is something about Brazil that maybe you were aware of it because you follow it every day. But a lot of people, as you say, didn't know this. The corruption, the crony capitalism, all of the stuff that is really hurting that society. And I don't know how much longer this is going to go on, but it's not good that it's gone this long.
Yeah, the whole thing is this. Every socialist society eventually crashes, whether it's Eastern Europe, whether it's, you know, Castro and Chavez are going to have their big explosive crash too. Or Western Europe, which is having these big type demonstrations. Well, Brazil, it's also that, and they're angry at the cronyism, they're angry at the special interests, they're angry at the taxes. And, you know, even though they're not as nasty as the others, maybe it's a little bit more comparable to, say, Greece and Spain, it's very, very tough to have to live like that and to not have any options. But here's the intriguing thing, and I didn't get into it in my editorial, I'd like to do a future one on this, is that the public doesn't have much awareness that there is a libertarian alternative or a conservative alternative. They don't have that. That's completely out of their ken. So they say, well, we just want more government spending. We want more free transportation. You don't understand. The problems you're seeing are the side effects of socialism. Those are not bugs. Those are features. And if you spend more in a socialistic way, you tax the rich even higher, or tax the middle class, or tax other people, you will get more of this. And so they're not aware of it. And that's why it's strange, the phenomenon of seeing like these Occupy-type masks at these and people yelling for free transport and whatever. You don't understand. That's if you call for what you're calling for, is simply going to keep looping it and keep you discontented. Here's another thing. The macro picture in Brazil is not terribly good. There's a certain tiredness. They've done the protectionism to protect, which is starved the oil industry of foreign investment, which it desperately needs, because their oil is very, very deep water. They need the most high tech they can get, and the protectionist movements, measures that they've put in there to protect, say, domestic producers, etc., that's hurting their oil development. But also they are the subject of a speculative attack. See, in Brazil, the big deal there, like from the 90s on and even before that, has always been monster inflation and monster interest rates. You know, 20% interest rates, that sounds scary. With them, they thought, oh, that's not too bad. That's just the standard there. So interest rates and inflation and the currency have always been things they watch carefully. There was a very, very good a president named Cardoso a few years ago who got these things under control. And then the socialists who followed tended to be pretty responsible. You know, they weren't spending like Chavez or doing awful things like that. But there is signs that they aren't producing as much. They're not living up to their potential as much as their currency is saying. So their currency is going to be dropping, and you're going to see their interest rates go up. And those are all big no-nos in Brazil. Even bigger no-nos in Argentina. They have just a phobia of hyperinflation. But in Brazil, we're seeing just the sort of the negative macro picture with speculative attacks. We don't know if Soros is doing it or what, but there was a very good story by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, I believe, of the, I think he's Telegraph, talking about a speculative attack 10 days ago, 10 days before the march, the riots and the unrest, and I think that could be related. So those are things that you definitely want to watch on that, because what Brazil needs is freedom. They need to get rid of the protectionism. They need to dump the regulation. They need to start laying off bureaucrats. They need to allow the startups to found, because Brazil is such a vibrant, creative type of country. They could do such a great job if they allowed their startups. You know, it takes more than a year to get a permit for a business in Brazil. You look at all of the indicators. Brazil is rock bottom. They're rock bottom on education, on transparency, on corruption. Not rock bottom, but I'd say the lower quadrant. They're not living up to their potential on that. And these, I feel, are side effects of socialism or a socialist government where you're protecting one class, but what you're doing is oppressing the larger class to do it.
Right. Interesting, interesting. Let me ask you a couple of other questions. This is what I pick up from talking to people, that there are some real regional disconnects in Brazil. You have these great cities in the coast, you know, doing fairly well, but then you have rural areas of the country, even within the cities, you have huge pockets of poverty. Could that, any of that, be behind this discontent, or is it something else?
Well, what you have, when you see people moving from the country into the city, you're going to, you know, you get the shanty towns and the shacks,
right,
and the in Brazil, it's the favelas. When you see that stuff, it's a society that's changing rapidly. And when you have that, you have people that are feeling lost and they're feeling discontented. You have kind of pre-revolutionary conditions in a certain way. You know, the vast move of people from the countryside to the city creates, you know, potential for unrest unless you can channel people's energies and you say, look, you can raise your standard of life, you can your kids will have a better future, etc. When those promises aren't fulfilled and people are just kind of rusting away and in favelas and taking government checks, you have a tinderbox type of situation. There are pockets of poverty and all that, but, you know, extreme grinding poverty, those people don't revolt. They just want, please, another meal. That's
right.
That, you know, you live almost a weirdly purposeful life. So those people don't revolt, but people who are on the outskirts looking in, who have rising expectations and these expectations aren't met, these people are the ones that are going to say, well, I'm going to try to change things.
Right. Let me ask you another question about the lady president of Brazil. Interesting lady. She was at one time in her younger days a radical herself, which is kind of ironic that now they'd be protesting against her, you know. But
that's the whole
what do you,
thing.
What do you think of this lady? What is your assessment of this lady as president?
To be honest, I like her. I think she has never done anti-American talk. She
right.
has distanced Brazil from Iran, which was a very good thing. She's made life tough for Chavez from time to time, although there are times when she's enabled him as well. But she doesn't hang out with the nasty radical crowd of Latin America, you know, Chavez or, you know, Correa and Ortega and all that stuff. She's friends with them, but she is not, busy saying, let's plot the United States' demise. She has very good relations with the U.S. I like her a lot. She was actually, she was a guerrilla girl, and she of Bulgarian descent, a guerrilla girl. She was the person who, when the guerrillas would do bank robberies and kidnappings, she was the woman who kept the books. And so naturally, she kept the books quite clean. And so she became a trusted guerrilla, and she rose very high as the guerrilla. So I would say, you know, there's probably some kind of accounting integrity in her mentality, despite
right,
her
right.
background.
Yeah, right. She's the bookkeeper.
And, yeah, as the honest bookkeeper, because the
right.
guerrillas insisted on that. And
that's
the
right.
communist terrorist guerrillas
right,
who did
right.
kidnappings and bank robberies. But she was good at that, and she was always a trusted aide. She was like Lula's chief of staff.
Mm.
I like her better than Lula, actually, because Lula did do some irresponsible things. She is far more responsible, but she does not know what to do. You know, she just said, well, I'll have a referendum, I guess, which is kind of, you know, just a kind of a left-wing way to try to solve things and try to include people, make it feel it more inclusive. But the reality is that she's got to let go of some socialist things, like the protectionism and the regulations and the bureaucrats, the global warming nonsense. Get rid of that. And that may be a bridge too far for her. That said, I can't imagine she'd be overthrown or something like that. It's not like it's Ecuador or something. But it is unfortunate that she's in this situation. I just always say, her name's Dilma Rousseff. Why Dilma, not Christina Kirchner? I mean, I wish Christina were having this problem.
Because she's
the one who deserves it. She's highly irresponsible, highly vain and egotistical. All kinds of repulsive human characteristic can be found on her. Whereas Dilma is like the responsible gorilla. So it's a peculiar thing.
Now, what about going forward, Monica? You know, you look, they're going to be, you know, within a year, right, in June of next year, roughly, they're going to have thousands of people coming into the country for the World Cup, the Olympics, a couple of years later. When you have that many people coming in, I mean, these protests, not only, they're not just embarrassing, but they're also a national security problem because, you know, there's elements of Al-Qaeda in South America who may want to use these opportunities to promote themselves. Are you concerned about that at all?
I find it highly concerning.
Good.
I don't know what they're going to do. Honestly, these things can flare up at any time if they don't get to the root of it, and so far they aren't getting to the root of it. One hopes maybe the Brazilians will just be caught up in the spirit of things, but unless they make sure every Brazilian who wants to go see a soccer game can go see a soccer game and it doesn't cost them $100 tickets, they're in for all kinds of trouble. And I simply don't know what they're going to do to head it off. I can see them doing tons and tons of security or something, but even that doesn't work.
Right. Well, there's a limit
not when you
to
have
that
much discontent. Yeah,
yeah, you know, I thought it was funny on Saturday or Friday, Sunday, I cannot remember, Friday or Saturday, Japan was playing Mexico in an absolutely meaningless game because both teams had been eliminated. And it seemed like the only intensity about the game was in the protest that was going on outside the stadium because there was no interest in Mexico in this game because they were angry that the team got eliminated. And Japan, well, they're not really soccer crazy. So I thought it was kind of funny that there was this huge protest outside the stadium. It had nothing to do with the game, but just another indication. But I don't know what's going to happen. But, I mean, this is a huge event coming up next year, Monica, and they have got to really they've got to control it. Otherwise, you know, with all the cameras that are going to be there, all the Twitter or the Facebook, all of these little, you know, mobile cameras and all of that, I mean, it really becomes a challenge. I mean, like, you remember that scene, that photograph of the woman who was being sprayed by the police officer, how quickly that got around the world. I mean, that can really be very embarrassing.
I think so. I think there's all kinds of potential for that, and there's potential for these people shutting down the games.
Right.
It's kind of mind-boggling. They've got to get some kind of grip on this very quickly, and do something to placate the population. And at this point, I don't think they have any answers. And
no.
You know, I don't know. It maybybe the Olympic Committee just moves it to another city or something.
Four years for that, right? That's 2016, so they have a little bit more time for that. But the World Cup, that's too late now to move anybody. But one of the things, I think one more thing I wanted to bring up. One of the things I hear again, just from picking up things in the man in the street type of interviews from Brazil, is that people are saying we're going to build this stadium that will have no utility whatsoever after the World Cup. So we're going to have all these white elephants sitting around, all these massive stadia and facilities that will have absolutely no use whatsoever for the people of Brazil. That's another concern, isn't it?
All I can say is welcome to Greece, because this is what happened in Greece. And Greece
right,
had the
South
96
Africa
Olympics.
Too, right?
Greece had the 96 Olympics, and that's one big reason why they're bankrupt now.
Right.
So that's the whole thing. What you need is a Peter Uberoth who will make the Olympics profitable and who will make sure everything pays for itself. Or for that matter, even Mitt Romney was able to do that. But Los Angeles was never left in the red. In fact, he left L.A. with hundreds of millions of dollars, which is used as a trust fund for kids' sports programs in Los Angeles. That was the way Uberoth did it, and that's the only way to do it. Instead, they're
that's
doing
right.
it the socialist way, which is to say the money-losing way. And this looks like, you know, it could be quite a Titanic. I'm just looking at it with with apprehension, because I don't see how they're going to be able to fix this. Although I know they want to, so maybe something can come up.
Yeah, well, that may be. You know, I hope so too, because we want Brazil to do well. But you're exactly right; they do have some structural problems. But Monica, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Monica Showalter, the editorial writer. I guess you're one of the editorial writers. Is that correct? Is that the way
that's
to say
correct?
It?
Yeah,
and
correct.
With the Investor Business Daily. And you know, one, I got to ask you a favor. You've got to get me an autograph of Michael Ramirez, because he is the greatest cartoonist in American journalism. He is great. If you get a chance someday, and you know you come and you know you're talking to him one day, and he says, "Hey, this guy in Dallas would love to have one of your cartoons autographed." He is fabulous. I love his work. But thank you so much for joining us today. You're absolutely great. We love your work, and keep it up. I mean, you're really one of the treasures of American journalism, and we just love what you do, especially with Latin America. It is fantastic, and we absolutely love it. And it's such a great honor to have you on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, I tell you what, before you say goodbye to me, I got to make sure I have the right file on, because I was going to push a button. All of a sudden, there was no file, but it's just a little radio thing that I was going through. Right. But have a great day, Monica. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a little break, and we've got Michael Prada on the other side. We're going to get into Colombia. What is happening in Colombia?
Hello, everybody. This is Aaron Clary, a.k.a. Captain Capitalism. Say, when you're done reading Cubanos in Wisconsin, why don't you head on over to my place, CaptainCapitalism.blogspot.com, and take a look at a couple of the books I got. I got Worthless, The Young Person's Indispensable Guide for Choosing the Right Major. That's a must for every college-going kid or their parents. Then there's Enjoy the Decline, if you're kind of sad and depressed about where the country and the economy is going, and you feel kind of helpless about not being able to do anything about it. That is a must for you as well. Life is too short to let people like Barack Obama ruin it. We also have Behind the Housing Crash. That's an old one, but if you want to figure out what was going on behind the housing crash, there you go. And then Captain Capitalism Top Shelf. That is the best of Captain Capitalism. Don't bother scouring my website. Just go and buy the book. Save yourself a lot of time or money. You can find them all available on Amazon, both paperback and Kindle.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. Again, our thanks to Monica Showalter. What a great resource she is, and how knowledgeable she is. I love chatting with her, and I love reading her work as well at Investors Business Daily. Just a quick update from Brazil today. I'm not a soccer fan, but as long as we're talking about Brazil, they beat Uruguay today 2-1, and I'm not even sure if that's the final or one of the semifinals, but I know one guy who knows, and that's Michael Prada. How are you, Michael?
Hi, how are you?
Now tell me, this game today between Brazil and Uruguay, was that the final or semifinal?
To be honest, I have no idea. I'm not a soccer fan either.
Oh, my God. Here I thought I was the only one in the – here I thought I was the only – you know, but Cubans, we have the excuse. We say we don't play soccer. But I thought, my God, somebody from Colombia like you would be soccer mad.
Not, believe me, a lot of people claim that I'm a fake Colombian because I don't like coffee, I don't like salsa music, and I don't like soccer. So
no salsa. Well, they don't actually play salsa. What they play is cumbia, right?
No, but they play salsa. It's huge in Colombia. It's huge, huge.
Oh, okay. So you don't like coffee, you don't like salsa, and you don't like football. So, yeah, we're going to have to take away your Colombian credentials, I think. Yeah, we're going to have to. Yeah, we're going to have to do something about that. But let me ask you, I think you heard a little bit of the interview, the chat that I had with Monica Showalter Investors Business Daily. Your reaction to what's happening in Brazil?
Well, I think it's very sad in the sense that again, it shows why, you know, governments in Latin America, they have a fame of being banana republics, that they cannot get anything done correctly. And Brazil was showing us or trying to prove us wrong, but apparently that's what's going on right now. The government, you know, is running behind scheduling many of the projects. Even private investors are running behind in many of the hotels and other infrastructure projects they're building. And there is a lot of social unrest in Brazil. Brazil was growing exponentially, you know, 7.5% each year, which is huge. But the wealth was being concentrated in a few. We were talking, you know, in many of the programs in the past, how Brazil, you know, had become the sixth largest economy ahead of the UK, and how it was supposed to overtake France in 2014. But the wealth was not evenly divided. I mean, there is a lot of wealthy people. I think Brazil creates about 3 new millionaires each day. But again, the middle class, lower middle class, and poor people, they have not benefited that much. And the whole protest erupted because of a hike on the price of the bus tickets. And now it's uncovering, you know, a whole array of social issues that have not been resolved.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it all started with the bus fare. But I think that was just, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back. There was probably, as Monica was saying, a lot of other stuff that had been building up there for quite some time. Well, let's talk about Colombia. I wanted to chat with you. We couldn't talk the other day when we did our regular U.S. Latin America show with Fausta. We couldn't talk about with you, and I wanted to talk a little bit about what's happening in Colombia with the FARC. Former President Uribe had expressed some concerns about some of these negotiations with the FARC. What is your assessment? What is the latest that you're hearing?
Well, the problem with the whole peace process in Colombia is the following. And this is a historical comparison that shows you the kind of things going on in Colombia right now. The FARC was in a position that it was very weak. It was close or nearly, you know, being defeated. And when, you know, President Santos assumed office, he immediately decided to engage in peace process with them. That would be the equivalent of having Marshal Zhukov, when he's at the gates of Berlin, you know, extend an olive branch to the Nazis and say, come on, let's talk and, you know, let's make peace. I mean, you don't do those kind of things when you're about to win. And this is what's happening right now. President Santos, who has never been elected for anything before running for president, he never ran for anything, nor even for PTA. He, you know, basically lied to President Uribe, misled the Colombian people, and made them believe that he was going to continue, you know, with Uribe's policies. But he has this urge to become his own person, to come outside, you know, the shadow of President Uribe. So he wants to go down in history as, you know, the president of peace, the one, the only one who has, you know, who will do what all other presidents have failed in doing, which is peace in Colombia. And first thing he did was to approach the guerrillas, offer them everything when he shouldn't have done that. And now, even in the, you know, in the table, in the peace process, he keeps giving them concessions, a concessions, a concessions. Now there is a talk about, you know, writing a new constitution. This is one of the demands that the FARC are making, that they want to rewrite, you know, they want a brand new constitution. So this kind of policy has generated, this kind of proposals, rather, have generated a lot of opposition, even among those who are in favor of the peace process. And President Uribe, he's right in that sense that, you know, the Colombian people have been misled. A lot of the Colombians, I don't have the number right now, but in polls that have been made, a majority of Colombians are against the peace process because there is a sense that the guerrillas are going to be able to get scot-free from all the crimes, the heinous crimes they have committed during the past 30 years. Let's not forget that the guerrillas have been involved in drug trafficking. They have assassinated a lot of innocent people, civilians. They have blown off legs and other limbs of, you know, thousands of Colombians. And many of their leaders are going to end up, you know, getting scot-free and becoming members of parliament or more, you know, or even higher office than that. And that's the thing that a lot of Colombians are really wary of.
Now let me ask you just so that I can understand a little bit of the background. President Santos comes in. I remember when President Santos came in because many of my Colombian friends here in the Dallas area were actually pretty happy. I mean, many of the friends of my friends here who were supporters of President Uribe felt that there would be a certain continuation of his policies. So President Santos comes in, and maybe for whatever reason he feels like, gee, we've been fighting this war for such a long time, maybe let's try to do a peace deal. Was he just naive, or as you say, was he just trying to win the Nobel Peace Prize, as we indicated.
I can assure you, this is a difference between people like General George Washington and people like President Uribe. They think about country first, not personal gain, no Nobel Peace Prize, no re-election, not about power. This guy, he's thinking about himself. He wants to go down in history as the president who achieved peace in Colombia, something that nobody else has been able to do. And he wants to overshadow President Uribe. He doesn't want to be a Medvedev, you know, vis-a-vis Putin, basically. He doesn't want to be seen as someone who's just holding the seat until the constitution is changed and Uribe can run again. He wants to be his own person, but he's doing it out of personal ambition. And a lot of people were misled because Mr. Santos, he used to be the Minister of Defense. And, you know, under his, you know, tenure in office as Minister of Defense, there were a lot of issues. One of them was the, you know, the attack of and the killing of a guerrilla leader, number one at the time, guerrilla leader of the FARC, that actually happened in, you know, Ecuadorian territory. And there was an order of capture of the Ecuadorian government against him. And, you know, so a lot of people thought he was a tough guy. But I never liked him because, again, he's basically a bureaucrat and someone who never ran for anything. And he basically lied to President Uribe and told him, I'm going to continue your legacy, et cetera, but once in power, he basically decided to break from Uribe and enact his own policies that, again, he wants to be liked by people. You can tell, you know, it's pretty obvious. Like, when I think I made this comment when he went to Chavez's funeral, he was like, oh, it was embarrassing. You know what I mean? Like, he was trying to stress out how he, you know, established relations with Venezuela and how Chavez and, you know, him were friends. And now he's inviting to the peace process a lot of the president of Uruguay, who used to be a member of the guerrillas in that country, in Uruguay. He's inviting him into the peace talk process. He's trying to be liked. He wants to be the popular kid in, you know, in the school.
Right, right.
And I think that
he wants to be loved, I guess. He wants to be loved, I guess that's what you're saying. And sometimes when you're the president of a country, particularly in a country in that kind of a situation where you've got a movement, a guerrilla movement trying to basically undermine the constitution and the freedoms of the country, sometimes you have to be tough, not necessarily loved, but you have to be tough. And but again, it surprises me, I guess maybe this is because I'm not from Colombia, maybe that's the difference between my perception of him and you. I was actually pleased when he became president. I thought, okay, here's Colombia continuing the policies of President Uribe. But I guess you didn't see it that way, Michael. You knew something that I didn't know.
Well, again, it goes to the fact that he never ran for anything. You know what I mean? And whatever little he accomplished in life was because of his last name. You know, Santos is a family, you know, they used to own the most, you know, the biggest and most prestigious newspaper in Colombia, El Tiempo, The Times. And, you know, his grandfather was the president of Colombia in the 40s. And, you know, a very political family, et cetera, et cetera. But he never achieved anything on his own, you know, vis-a-vis, again, Mr. Uribe, whose, you know, dad was not involved in politics. He came from, you know, basically from nowhere. He made his political career on his own. And Mr. Uribe, he's not perfect. He's not far from, you know, a lot of criticism during his government. You know, there was a lot of corruption and and, you know, a lot of things going on. But he made it himself. Mr. Santos, he has been a product of his last name. And even his cousin, Mr. Francisco Santos, who was President Uribe's, you know, vice president for 8 years, even his own family is criticizing him because he's he's in a rush to achieve the peace process before the presidential elections that are going to take place next year.
Right.
I believe it's in May of 2014.
Now, will Santos is running for re-election?
He's running for re-election, and not only that, he was a couple of weeks ago, about a month ago or so, he was hinting, and, you know, 4 years are not enough for me, for anybody, you know, to be in office, not for senators or governors or mayors. So why don't we extend it to 6 years? You know, I mean, he was trying to push that idea. And right now he's running. Yeah, he announced that about a month ago. And, you know, the problem is that he ran with President Uribe's party, the party of the U. The U, it's basically Uribe's first, you know, letter in his last name.
Sure.
And the party itself is divided right now. The party itself is divided. And President Uribe, he created a new political party, which is called the Democratic Center.
Right.
And yesterday, there was a public meeting with lower-ranking officials in Colombia, like council members, etc. And President Uribe said that the U party, the party that was created after, you know, because of him, was finished. And that was using them, he was referring to the council members for the elections, but that the party was finished. And now President Santos, what he's trying to do is he's trying to create like some sort of like intent cordial, like, you know, a coalition of people, including members of the opposition, including the Liberal Party that used to be one of the most powerful parties in Colombia. And that ran against him 4 years ago. Now he's going to bring a guy from that party to become his vice president, his running mate for the new election. So that's what he's trying to do.
Well, that's interesting. And now, are there any reliable polling data that would suggest where he stands on re-election? I mean, is he likely to be re-elected, or is he like? I mean, what kind of polling data is there? Or perhaps there is no polling data, but what are you getting?
Well, there was a poll, and again, it was a very small sample. I don't remember the exact numbers right now, but that was around the time where he was about to announce that he was running for re-election, which I think it was 69% of Colombians were against, you know, his decision of running again, running for re-election, because people don't like him. And he's not a likable person. He's not charismatic. He comes across as someone, I mean, like a bureaucrat that he's not someone that you can remember, like, oh my God, what an amazing, great guy, smart. No, he's not
right. That
kind of a person. So right now he's trying, and not only him, and like this ties into the whole situation with Brazil. The political class in Colombia, the people who are right now in power, the vast majority of them members of the U party, that used to be Uribe's party, they're a bunch of opportunists, and right now they will do anything they can to remain in power, and many of them, the majority of them, are backing Santos because they want to remain in power. They want the embassy for their friends, they want the consulate here, they want the ministry, they want, you know, they want these kind of offices, and they will do anything to stay in power.
Right, so they just want the privileges, you know, the benefits that come from being in power. They want the drivers, they want the nice homes, and all of that stuff. Well, it's an interesting situation going on in Colombia. I mean, I have to confess that a few years ago when Uribe left the presidency, I was very optimistic about Colombia. I thought Uribe had done a lot of the hard work, he had done a lot of the tough work, and in many ways he had set the table for somebody to follow him and just continue with the good stuff that he had started. You know, Uribe had to, you know, sometimes you need somebody to go in there and do all the hard work. I think Uribe was that kind of a president. And so I'm disappointed that some of his good works have not been followed by President Santos. But we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But the negotiations with the FARC, I guess, right now are just not going very well.
Yes, again, the government is trying to rush the whole process because they want to show the people, and that's basically that's what he's basing his whole re-election campaign on. Because I mean, what else? He doesn't have a record of anything else. What's his track record? Oh, I lost, you know, 80% of our, you know, continental sea in the Caribbean to Nicaragua. Of course, that's not going to be the one, or the economy is suffering. No. I mean, he doesn't have anything else to show. So he's trying to railroad this whole peace process, and I don't think it's going to happen. And people are seeing the peace process for what it is. It's just a show. In the early 2000s or earlier in the late 1990s, when there was this other peace process under President Pastrana, the guerrillas used the whole process to show off, travel around, you know, get press, launder their money, buy weapons, capture new territory, and then they became stronger. And I believe that that's what they're going to do right now.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. Anything new, by the way? One last question here, but anything new with this International Court of Justice decision to basically give Nicaragua those islands? Has anything happened on that, or has that sort of been forgotten?
Yes, actually, there is more. I mean, to add also insult to injury, Nicaragua is about to sue Colombia again because they won the islands. They are not happy with only getting 80% of the sea that has belonged to Colombia for centuries. Now they want the islands, and they are suing, are planning to sue Colombia. So Colombia, and this happened, Monday or Tuesday, and now Colombia is, putting together a legal team, et cetera, et cetera. So that situation, that was a total.
So that could end up back in that could end up back in the International Court of Justice, I guess, and and Colombia could actually suffer another defeat. I hope not, but unfortunately, that's what happens when you allow yourself to go to these international, court of justice. I mean, look, I've never believed that these people have any jurisdiction over the sovereignty of Colombia, or for that matter, any other country. I don't know if you remember a few years ago when President Bush would not allow the United States to get into some of these international disputes because there's nothing clean about these organizations. They're basically anti-American, and I think that one of the big reasons that, and this is just my opinion, but I think one of the big reasons Nicaragua won that dispute had more to do with the fact that many of these justices, many of them Europeans, were bigger fans of Ortega than Uribe. I think a lot of it had to do with that.
Absolutely. I mean, like, it's sad as it is, we know that in Europe, the left is rampanting, the social democrats control a lot of the courts and all the kind of stuff. These kind of, like, Baltasar Garzón kind of judges, they're all over the place in Europe, and they don't know what people have to go through. They have this romantic view of Robin Hood trying to help the poor, when the reality is, like, these socialist leaders and communist leaders in Latin America, they actually oppress the people, and they live like the bourgeoisie that they hate so much.
Right.
So I find it ridiculous. And just something else very interesting about Colombia and the situation of Colombia right now is the fact that violence is, it's become worse. A member of the of the DEA was killed in Colombia this past
week. Yes, I remember that. Yeah, in the last week or so, right?
Yes, and the number of kidnappings are starting to pick up. The ELN, which is the second biggest guerrilla group in Colombia, they kidnapped. I think it was a group of German tourists. I mean, the situations are getting tough, and this president has nothing to show. He's been lucky that the economy keeps going, and in comparison with the disaster of Venezuela and Ecuador and the rest of the region, the economy still looks good, but he has done nothing on his own that can, that can pull him through a re-election, that people can say, oh, he did this.
Right. Very interesting. Very interesting analysis, Michael. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, and we'll get back together with you and Fausta in our next U.S. Latin American show. I'm glad that we could at least have you tonight. We missed you the other night, but we have you tonight, and that was a great chance to catch up with what's going on with FARC and with Colombia. So thank you so much. Now, you're out of school now, right? Your school is over, right?
Yes, school is over. So now I'm looking for jobs right now. So.
Oh, okay. So you're in the job-seeking mode, which is, we wish you the best on that.
Thank you.
But you're also going to be taking a class, right? You mentioned you were taking a class as well.
Yeah, I'm trying to get into a class that General Petraeus is going to be teaching at my school, which is CUNY, City University of New York. He's going to be teaching a seminar that's going to be meeting once a week. So I would love to take that class with him. So I'm trying.
Yeah,
to
I bet that would be interesting. I bet that would be interesting sitting in. Is there going to be a national security class?
It's the title of the class itself is The Next American Decade, and what I read from the abstract, General Petraeus is contending that, you know, America is gonna, you know, take the re-lead of the world in the next decade or so, or at least in the Western Hemisphere. So that's what he's predicting.
Well, that's interesting. I would love to. Is it based on a book that he wrote, or is it just
a class? Yeah.
Yeah, I've always felt that that Petraeus should write a book someday. I think he's had some pretty amazing stories that I'm sure he could share with lots of people. But thank you very much, Michael. Thank you very much, and good night. And we look forward to you and Faust the next time.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
All right. We're going to take a little break. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back for a closing commentary.
Canto Group is a recruiting firm located in Dallas, Texas that specializes in the placement of executives and engineering professionals with companies throughout Texas. If your company is seeking quality candidates in the fields of general managers, plant managers, sales, CFOs or controllers with a manufacturing background, production manager supervisors, engineering specializing in mechanical, manufacturing, industrial, electrical, safety, or quality engineers or designer drafters, feel free to contact our team regarding your company's future or current openings. Contact Silvio Canto Jr., email thecantogroup@aol.com, or visit our website, thecantogroup.com.
Well, this is Silvio Canto on Wednesday night, June the 26th, and our thanks to Monica Showalter from the Investor's Business Daily and her thoughts about Brazil. Very interesting situation going down in Brazil, and you know, I think that situation down there is just probably going to get worse for a while before it gets any better, and because I think they've, you know, it's like the straw that breaks the camel's back. It's sort of tough to put it back together, so it may get worse before it gets any better. And the big thing, of course, is that they have they have the World Cup coming up in 12 months. In 12 months, they're going to have all these athletes and all these people from all over the world who are going to be watching the games. And a lot of people do follow that. I know we here in America don't get as excited about it, but, you know, around the world, and especially in Brazil, that's a big thing. So there'll be thousands of people in the streets, thousands of people in the country. So I'm sure they're going to try to do their best to contained these demonstrations. Then we talked with Michael Prada, got an update of what's happening in Colombia with these negotiations with FARC. Again, I don't know what President Santos was thinking when he initiated these talks. I thought for a while there maybe he was naive. I thought for a while he was just maybe doing something. But you would think by now that he would be pulling back and realizing that this is a big mistake. Well, he's not, unfortunately. And as a consequence, I think that there's a lot of problems in the country. And some of the problems are not all his fault, let's be fair about it. But nevertheless, he is the president right now. And when you're the president, I guess you get blamed for all the good things. And you get all the credit and you get all the blame. That's just the way it is when you're president these days. Well, that's going to do it for tonight. Tomorrow night, we're going to be talking to Leslie Eastman. And she's got a couple of ladies known as the Victory Girls. And we're going to be talking a little politics from a conservative perspective, some conservative ladies and their thoughts on politics. And there's a lot going on, particularly with these two Supreme Court decisions today regarding same-sex marriage and so on. So we'll be getting into a little bit of that tomorrow night. And then, of course, on Friday, we will do our weekly review of the American economy with Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe. Everybody have a wonderful night, and we'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.